Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, January 9th, 2015. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by John Palguta of the Partnership for Public Service. I caught you while you're taking a slug of the water. It's great to have you. Thanks for coming in, and Happy New Year.
Thank you, Francis, and the same to you, sir.
It's great to see you. And Tim Young of Deloitte's here and doing the same thing. The timing is impeccable. Drinking the water as I'm calling your name. Thanks for coming in, my friend. Happy New Year to you, and thank you for being on again. It's always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You've each chosen the three most important federal news stories of the week, according to yourselves, and we've ranked them in order, and you'll count them down, starting with...
Number three!
And John, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is by our friend Don Kettle. It's published in Washington Monthly, and it is titled, 10 Secret Truths About Government Incompetence, What You Can Learn from the Management Mistakes of Obama and Bush. And Don is certainly bipartisan here in calling out our friends like Tim, who were in the Bush administration, and our many friends in the Obama administration. But the first point that Don makes here is the one I want to focus on for the time that we have to talk about this. And that is, government works better than people think most of the time. And you know, we push hard to try to dig up these success stories in government and tell them as often as we can. And it's something that we have in common with you at the partnership.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Francis, this is not the typical sort of story that we cover in these discussions.
Yeah.
But I thought Don did such a nice job here. And he's written this story as if it were a memo to the president who will come in after the 2016 elections. And I thought it was it was worthy of mention, and he does a great job in the sense that right after the 2014 midterm elections, we were talking about the next presidential election, and there's going to be a lot of campaigning about all the problems in government and elect me and I'll fix things, and it was important It's going to be important for the next president, but for the general public to understand it's not all as you hear it is in during campaign mode. There's a lot of things government does well. There are things that, are not working well, but it's all not on the executive branch. Our legislative branch has to bear, some of that burden. And I thought it was just important. This is a good time to reflect on the fact that, look, there's a lot of misconceptions and there's a lot of erroneous things going on out there about how government works. And Don gave us a nice heads up that we should think about some of this stuff, including you mentioned point one, but just one of the other points, we don't distinguish between things that go wrong that are really consequential and things that go wrong that, hey, it happens, but we in government, we make a big deal about it for the news cycle and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to distinguish between what's really important and what's, just that's the way things sometimes bounce.
He's got 10 bullets in this, and I commend them to you. They're linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, like all the stories from the countdown today. The theme that I took away as I read what he wrote, John, was, here are some points to consider that you, as the next president of the United States, may not think or may be contrary to what was discussed on the campaign trail about the job that you now have in front of you, which is to manage the affairs of the business of the United States of America. Do you think that's a fair takeaway on my part?
It is a fair takeaway, and also because I'm an old, HR guy, you got a lot of really good people mm-hmm. in government to help you do it. If you let them and if you support them and invest in them.
I'm struck by the discussion on the Republican side now, and I know we're 2 years away, but most of the candidates that people are talking about now are governors. I'm separating out the ideology, doesn't have anything to do with the political issue, but does the fact that, does it make a difference, I guess, that somebody potentially comes into the office of president understanding how an executive branch runs?
I think that could be extremely important. George Voinovich from Ohio is Republican governor. I think he got it. Mm-hmm. He understood, the importance of if government's going to work well, you've got to do it with the people, your workforce. And he was very focused. He was the champion mm-hmm. for the civil service because he understood that's how you make government deliver services to the population.
Don Kettle's piece in Washington Monthly, 10 Secret Truths About Government Incompetence, What You Can Learn from the Management Mistakes of Obama and Bush, is John Palguda's choice as the third most important federal news story of the week. Tim, your choice at number three is from the Federal Times. It's Andy Medici's story, Postal Service Credits IT Modernization for Recent Success. The numbers behind what's going on at the Postal Service are pretty impressive considering what the overall numbers at the Postal Service are. What was it that you saw here in Postmaster General Donahoe's speech at the National Press Club that Andy reported on that struck you as particularly noteworthy?
So I selected this one as number three primarily because it's a great example, in my view, of taking an enabling technology to produce an outcome that is cost savings, quantifiable, that is also improving delivery to citizens and also helps with small businesses. In this case, Postal Service modernized its back-end IT modernization, which enabled it to offer a precise solution called Every Door Direct Mail that allows some small businesses to target specific towns and receive data on their direct mailings to have a more targeted approach to mailings, whether it's marketing or other content-rich outlets, to help with the way in which small businesses gain traction. And this was an example that I think, you know, doesn't get picked up often enough, right? We talked about the last story in the report where, you know, it's easy to use the federal government as a punching bag, but we don't talk enough about the great successes that do occur on a day-to-day basis. This is one of those day-to-day occurrences that I did want to highlight because in my experience working in the federal government for almost six long years, we didn't have a lot of these that got highlighted in the process. And the people that are behind these types of reforms are hardworking, committed people that don't just collect a paycheck. And they're using something like an IT modernization to accomplish a societal benefit, not just a cost savings benefit, but a societal benefit. And that's why I thought it was noteworthy.
One of the things regarding IT modernization that I talked about with your former colleague, Mark Forman, on the program yesterday was that the broader concept of IT modernization is finally conceptually changing across the government. And that is that agencies are no longer stopping their activity every 5 to 7 years, or maybe sooner than that, but letting periods of time elapse and say, okay, now we need to relook at our operations and see what we need to modernize. It's becoming an ongoing process, and it's even surpassing, in some cases, refresh cycles for technology. Is that something that you're seeing, too, in your practice?
It is, and I have a few additional articles that are going to talk about it, but with the evolution of digital, native digital for government, there are now opportunities to yield great outcomes, whether they're cost savings, improved customer service, speed of deployment, a number of different benefits through digital solutions in a very short span of time with a low capital investment. And that's why you're seeing these surpass traditional refresh cycles, which do be, you know, the 3, 4, 5 years when you look at a major IT modernization. It also helps with political appointees who have a limited time in government because most political appointees want the same thing, which are, you know, accomplishments for their next job. And this gives them opportunity to yield those benefits and results so that they don't have to wait 2 terms of a presidential administration to start and finish something, because very few actually do.
Tim Young's third most important federal news story of the week is from the Federal Times. The headline, Postal Service Credits IT Modernization with Recent Success. You can find it and all of our stories as selected by Tim Young and John Palguda on the Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories as chosen by John Palguda of the Partnership for Public Service and Tim Young of Deloitte. And we are up to
number two.
And Tim Young, your second most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Advisor Guides Obama into the Google Age. I do note that the headline writers at the Times in the story about Megan Smith did not make it Advisor Guides Obama into the BlackBerry Age, because Ms. Smith didn't make many friends with the BlackBerry people when she commented on kind of the archaicness. Is that a word?
Yes.
Or did I just make one up?
You can hyphenate it.
Anyway, this story about her is, I think, an interesting microcosm of the administration's efforts to get people who are really doing technology in the very front lines at the very highest levels in Silicon Valley and get them to Washington and get them to work on the problems of the American people.
Yeah, so I picked this one primarily because it's a refreshing ad to the administration by dipping into Silicon Valley, taking a thought leader who's going to try to pioneer some new things for the federal government. The other reason I picked this particular news article is because I think it highlights some of the challenges that technology leaders have in the government. I was in a position when I went to work for OMB that I had prior government consulting experience doing some technology work with agencies. What I didn't have was deep expertise in innovation and incubating something new, like what Megan brings to the table. And I think that this highlights the need to have both, in my view, is someone who's going to push the envelope and question the platforms that have been used in the government that many would want to continue to use, even though they may be obsolete or inferior from a technical perspective, but balance that with career executives who understand the limitations and constraints of the federal government and where you can and cannot push the envelope. It'll be the difference between focusing on being right versus focusing on getting it right. Oftentimes when you bring in executives from the outside, they have their own vision for what government should look like, which is to run it like a business. And I believe there's certain aspects of the government that should be and can be run like a business, but there's also certain parts that doesn't make a lot of sense to run it as a business because of culture and process and the transparency associated with government operations. But I think, Megan's appointment and the fact that she brings a fresh eye to this is key going forward. One of the things I would be looking for out of this new appointment is clarity associated with her role as chief technology officer in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy versus the federal, or what is it called, the national chief information officer, which is in OMB, versus the new digital services group, which is in the White House. Actually, that's also in OMB.
Yes.
And how they're going to work together to impact change. In my view, that can be best done with a lot of coordination where you're rowing in the same direction. But it's just not clear from an outsider's perspective now how that's going to work.
The part of the one sentence, John, in this piece that summed up what readers of the New York Times probably didn't know, but that the three of us in this room and anybody listening to this program probably did know, is this sentence right here. The woman whose division at Google dreamed up Google Glass and the driverless car is facing culture shock in a federal bureaucracy ruled by creaky technology and run in part on the floppy disk. Now, I take the creaky technology thing and the floppy disk thing as kind of an unfair shot. That's a little bit of a crack. But the culture shock piece of it for somebody coming from a company like Google or Facebook or any of the other cutting edge Silicon Valley companies into a Washington, D.C. government community, that's probably a pretty big culture shock, don't you think?
It is. And I think part of it kind of goes back to part of our previous discussion, the risk averseness that almost is mandated in government, because if you innovate and you're trying new things, not everything always works. But if you try something and you fail in government, it's all heck breaks loose, as opposed to this one didn't work. We'll learn from it and try something else. So I think government tends not to be as cutting edge as it could be. And I think what's cool here is the in Tim's selected story is when you marry some of that private sector entrepreneurial spirit with a government, you can actually do some good things. And I'm thinking about the initial launch of the Affordable Care Act website, total disaster. But what happened? They brought in some private sector types and you had a task force thing, and within a few months they actually fixed it. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge deal. So maybe this is actually kind of illustrating that, there are ways to bring government maybe kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
And there's additional examples that in my view, don't get enough airtime, pardon the pun here, where the government did incubate something that is of global significance. I mean, it's well known that the government had a very strong hand in the development of the internet through DARPA. Same thing for GPS. Same thing for the lithium battery. And those examples, I think, illustrate the best of government when you can apply resources, great thinking, partnership with the private sector, and focus on results and outcome. And so just take a step back and comment on your last story. Leadership and management in government really does matter. Now, a president is not going to get elected to the Oval Office because on his top of his platform, he says, I'm going to manage the federal workforce and I'm going to focus on leadership development within the civil service. That said, though, we have seen great examples of where leadership and management were applied with great outcomes. We've also seen some technical examples of where it was missing. My view on this is that when you have a president surround himself with great leaders, whether they are political appointees in Silicon Valley or they're career civil servants that have spent the last 20 years trying to incubate something new, you're going to get great outcomes when there's focus on results and transparency to performance. So my hope for this new appointment is for the last 2 years, it does create a culture of change and taking on some isolated risks and trying to push the envelope a little bit relative to moving away from status quo.
There is one, I think there's a factual mistake in this piece that I want to double check. This story says Ms. Smith herself, the country's third chief technology officer and the first woman to hold the job. I think she's the third CTO for President Obama. We had Anish Chopra, and then Todd Park, and then Megan Smith, and Norm Lorenz was actually the first CTO.
So,
if I'm not mistaken,
you're both right.
Okay.
So the first CTO as the title was Norm Lorenz at OMB.
Uh-huh.
That position only existed until we created the chief architect role.
Okay.
Within OMB, because the view and I was part of that change, was that for OMB to be making technical platform decisions on behalf of the rest of the government would marginalize federal CIOs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got away from that title because we wanted to empower federal CIOs to make those decisions based on the drivers and the mission of their particular departments and their programs. In this administration, they elevated both the what used to be called the eGov administrator role to the federal CIO role, and they created a new position within the Office of Science and Technology Policy called the Chief Technology Officer. In my experience in the government, we didn't need the chief technology officer. Now, that was 6-7 years ago now, and technology has evolved in a way in which I think probably more direction and more standards at a central level are needed. But technically, this is the third CTO within the Obama administration, the third CTO within the Office of Science and Technology Policy, but technically the fourth in the government.
So Norm lived in the eGov administrator's office. Okay. Excellent clarification. That's why I asked you. I knew you'd know.
Thanks, sir.
Tim's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. Advisor guides Obama into the Google age. John Palguda, your choice at number two this week is my colleague Emily Kopp's story. MSPB says holding fair open job competitions isn't easy in government. And I give Emily a lot of credit here. She hit some third rails that the MSPB report didn't come right out and say. And Emily, I don't think, interpreted anything. I think she just reported on what was included there. But I've heard some feedback already from IT people who are saying, from HR people who are saying, well, it's about time some of these things got highlighted that the Merit Systems Protection Board is talking about here because they're causing the intentions are great.
Yeah.
But the consequences are not as good as they could be for the federal government.
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, truth in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
This is a report put out by the Office of Policy and Evaluation at the Merit Systems Protection Board. And I used to be the director of that office. I left that job 13 years ago to join the Partnership for Public Service. But this is a report, if people read it, everybody's going to find something to disagree with or take issue with. But what I think is important is that it actually highlights some real problems with the federal hiring system. We've been saying at the partnership, and we're certainly not alone, that the federal hiring system is broken. This kind of goes into more depth and detail about some of the things that aren't working well. What's going to cause some controversy and dialogue, and I'm sure it already has, is the solutions. They point out the impact of using some special hiring authorities, like those that are devoted towards bringing more veterans in or people with disabilities. They talk about the impact of agency managers who are looking for workarounds because they can't handle 10,000 applications that mm-hmm. come in. You can't. They can't use it, so they're looking for ways to reduce that size by either, looking only within government or holding the job open for 2 days rather than, and I think the important thing is not whether you agree or disagree with any of those individual things. It's there's got to be a better way for the federal government to hire good people. It's not working well. They actually start the report by going back to that 1883 Civil Service Act that first put into place. The funny thing is I've actually read that act recently. It's 3 pages. It was very simple. We're going to go from a spoils system to hiring people based on their ability to do the job. From that very simple principle, we've so ornamented the process and we've got so many things that we have to try to juggle that we're actually doing a worse job than if we didn't have those systems in place. There's a way to do it better.
Do we know what that way is, though, Tim? I mean, there are a lot of people who say what John very definitively says, and I'm not disagreeing with you, John. I want to be clear. But my fear is that if you ask 10 people what's the way to do it, you'd get 10 different answers, and that's what's holding up the progress. Is that fair?
So I think it is fair, and I think it all depends on what position you're trying to hire for, right? So the process to apply for and be vetted and get hired as a NASA astronaut, it has to be different than being hired as an HR specialist at OPM. That said, the current process of filling out an application and trying to tie certain words to certain standards in the position description and hoping that you make the best qualified list to get an interview is broken. And I have personal experience with this because in my experience at OMB, I put out position descriptions to hire people. And when I would look at the applications coming in, I would look and ask, are these the most qualified people? And then I would ask the HR specialist, can you give me a list of the applications that didn't make the CERT? The CERT is the qualified list that the HR department does. And I would look at some of the experiences of those individuals, and it was leading edge, what we used to call eGov. It was leading edge for e-commerce at that point in time. They didn't have the buzzwords. They didn't have a long tenure in the government. They couldn't say that their core competencies match directly to the position description, which is why they didn't make the certification list and why ultimately they didn't get the position. Many of those people would have been phenomenal for my old office, but I was not able to hire them because of the way in which the standards were based and the application process. GSA's 18F organization recently has used some streamlined hiring authority to hire specialists with deep technical expertise in a quick way to GSA to focus on that program, which is GSA's digital program that has a government-wide purview. That's an example of something that I think has worked because they've hired a lot of people in a short span of time. The question is, how do we scale that for like positions in government? But I believe this is an area that's gonna require OMB and OPM leadership to change the regulations and to make it a lot easier, not only for people to apply for those positions, but for government to vet them in a quick way and reduce the time to hire in the government.
One of the things this report touches on, John, and as far as it seems to me, at least from the folks that I've talked to, it's the 800-pound gorilla in the HR room, and that is veterans' hiring preference right now. The amount of points that vets get are, in some cases, sucking all the oxygen out of the room. And of course, you can't be the person who comes out and says, we're giving veterans too much preference, because you don't want to be you can't be the guy that's against the vets. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And there's a very good point to be made here. The concept of giving veterans some preferential consideration goes back. There's actually some of it going on after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
There is no debate. There's no question about, should we give veterans some special consideration for the service they provide to the country? That's been answered. The answer is yes. So it's not the what, it's the how. And that's what you're touching on, Francis.
Mm-hmm.
How do we provide that preferential consideration? And I'll tell you, it has changed dramatically over the years. You used to take a test. You get 5 or 10 points added to your score on that test, and that was it. Now we don't do a test anymore. We put people in categories. And if you're a veteran, you're at the top of the category regardless. And the category may have 1,000 people in it. And so people are being told, if you're not a veteran, we cannot hire you.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the intent of Congress. So it's not the what. We need to find a way to do to give preferential consideration to vets. It's the how we do it. That's a good subject for debate.
And the the implications there are a lot deeper even than just the makeup of the workforce. All of the efforts that not just the federal government, but that every company makes at diversity are you want to have as many different voices and worldviews and perspectives at the table as you possibly can. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. So an interesting phenomenon point, and this is an anecdotal story, so I'm not claiming that it's universal, but I heard a story about a person walking into a very high-level meeting in an agency, and there were 12 people around the table, and it was otherwise a very diverse group, but this person noted 9 of the 12 people around the table were veterans, had been in the military at some point. So is that diversity-wise, is that part of what we're going for in the government? Because if there were 9 men out of 12, we would say, well, that's probably not as diverse as we would like it to be. If there were not, if the racial makeup was 9 out of 12, that's probably not as diverse as we'd like it to be. And yet we're seeing this more and more across the federal government.
Yeah, I get to talk to a lot of HR people in government, especially at the higher levels, and they are very concerned about diversity. There's a merit system principle put into law in 1978, very short and simple. It says, you know, we're going to hire people who are, you know, relatively best capable to do the job and in a manner to achieve diversity in government. Two facts real quick. There's 8% of the civilian labor pool out there in the country are veterans, 8%. Last year, almost half of all people hired into government into full-time permanent jobs were veterans. So it's, you know, and that's the highest it's ever been. The percentage of women in government declined. Yet women now represent most of the college grads. You know, the majority of the college grads are women, et cetera. But their representation of the government workforce actually declined. I think there's a connection.
This is something that we'll see play out a lot more throughout the coming year, I believe. And John, we'll look forward to your expertise on that. The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Palgutis from federalnewsradio.com. MSPB says holding fair, open job competitions isn't easy in government. That and all of our stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Tim Young of Deloitte, John Palguta, the Partnership for Public Service. Be right back. Nicole Blake Johnson's story in FedTech Magazine, what IT budget authority really means for CIOs. Now, I have said for a while that I think that when all of these CIOs get the budget authority that they've been asking for years, they should be careful what they ask for. And now, according to Fitara, they will have some of this autonomy that they've been asking for. And it will be interesting to see how it develops. Now, Sunny Hashmi is talking to Nicole here. And Sunny's the Chief Information Officer at the General Services Administration, doing a terrific job there. But as I read what he's talking about, he gets it. I wonder what your thoughts are about what this could really mean, though, across the spectrum of the CIO community.
So the reason I picked this as the number one probably technology-oriented story of the week is that it represents – the Federal IT Acquisition Reform Act represents the largest sweeping reform for federal IT since the Clinger-Cohen Act of 1996 and the EGOV Act of 2002. That said, I don't believe that – this will have wholesale positive change for the federal government and how we manage technology and how CIOs operate. This tries to provide some balance, I think, to a department-level CIO having the responsibility to manage technology as an enterprise asset versus the authority to impact procurements and personnel decisions. It gives them, at least on paper, the budget for major technology acquisitions. It gives them the authority to have hiring decisions vetted through them at bureau levels for senior positions. All of that, I think, is well-intentioned. The question, I think, for consideration is how will this be rolled out department by department? Because in my observation in working with many CIOs, those CIOs who had the most authority granted to them to manage technology as an enterprise asset did so through influence, relationships, and results, not because of a secretarial order or a piece of legislation that Congress passed. They got a seat at the table because they did something phenomenal, right? Which is managing not only down and across, but managing up and out with their broader stakeholders, whether it's mission stakeholders or the secretary or the deputy secretary. Those are the CIOs, frankly, that in my observation, had the greatest positive impact for their departments. There are other CIOs, which I won't mention by name for obvious reasons, that want this legislation because they think it'll get them a seat at the table. And in my experience, it won't, because Congress just saying thou shalt does not mean that every secretary and every deputy secretary across the cabinet agencies are going to see the way in which their department is run. I think there's a balance. I believe that the balance is between giving someone responsibility to accomplish an outcome and giving them the authority, maybe that's shared authority, to accomplish that with their peer group. I think, you know, there's some examples in government at VA, at Department of Interior, where they've tried some OCIO reorganizations to find that balance. And I think there's been some mixed results across. In my view, though, I think trying to legislate a solution through this piece of legislation that was, I think it was tied to the Defense Appropriations Act.
Defense author, yeah.
Yeah.
NDA.
So having it tied to that and expecting that it's going to be universally adopted across all the agencies is a bit naive.
Well, we could probably do the whole rest of the show on the unfulfilled potential of Clinger-Cohen and how many of the things that are included in FITARA were at least inspired by things that were provided for in Clinger-Cohen that never happened. John, one of the things that I note here, though, that, and Tim touched on it, is the CIO landscape as it's tied to the rest of the CXO community is basic people skills and leadership skills and management skills. It's not necessarily IT stuff. And this gets to an issue that you and I have talked about before, which is how the federal government elevates people, at least in the career spots, moving people up who are technically excellent, but not necessarily who have terrific leadership or management skills or experience.
That's right. And when I was reading the story that Tim selected, you know, the thing that came to mind was, you know, some of the CIOs out there who are really good are going to do some fantastic things. There's a couple out there that are going to have this new authority, mm-hmm. You know, there's also going to be the increased capability for some disasters, because it's not just I'm the smartest IT person, but, you know, I know how to manage, I know how to work with other folks and so on. We see something, they don't have this authority, but, you know, the creation of the Chief Human Capital Officer position, which was actually, you know, just a few years back, 2002, was to create a seat at the table,
mm-hmm.
In statute. You know, you're not going to report through somebody. You're going to be the Chief Human Capital Officer. Every agency has to have one. And that actually was helpful. But what we also learned was that you can have the seat at the table, but that doesn't mean that you automatically have something to offer.
Right.
You have to earn the right to be heard.
Yep.
Now, you know, you had the right to be heard, but now you also got a couple clubs here under this. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But it's going to be like any good tool. Your ability to use that tool well would make all the difference.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier, Tim, is reflected in this piece about the ability of a leader to earn the trust of the people that he or she works with, and to be able to develop a portfolio of authority. This piece says, GSA was an early adopter of the consolidated IT approach, and Hashmi's experienced the benefits and challenges of having the agency's IT under his authority. I would attribute a lot of that to Casey Coleman, who, despite transition after transition after transition at the at the top of GSA, was able to demonstrate a record of success and then give all of those leaders throughout her tenure at GSA the reason to trust her and say, you know what, if she says this is how something should be when it comes to IT in this agency, then this is how it should be. And that, I think, is one of the benefits that Sonny's reaping, because he's gained the trust already of Dan Tangerlini.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at what a CIO owns, it's basically four skills. It's time, talent, budget, and relationships. And to be effective as Casey was and as Sonny is continuing to be successful, they exert those authorities in the right manner with the right level of pressure at the right time. And invoking a piece of statute that says, I'm in charge, you must listen to me, I'm going to take your money away from you and make all the decisions, is inconsistent with how the democracy was stood up. And I believe from my experience that those who invoke the legislation as why change needs to occur and why people need to listen to them will not be as successful as those who use the additional talent, time, relationships, and budget at their discretion in the right manner. And we're seeing some of this playing out right now in the federal government. You know, it's actually good timing because as we get to the last 2 years of an administration, there's usually high attrition. People are motivated based on maybe individual priorities versus organizational priorities. And this gives the federal CIO an opportunity to step up, you know, per John's comment, or not. And we'll see the test of time over the next 2 years if the legislation actually enables greater success or impedes it.
Tim Young's most important federal news story of the week is from FedTech Magazine, What IT Budget Authority Really Means for CIOs. We have a link to it and all of the stories on the countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by John Palguda as we wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. This is In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, the Federal News Countdown with the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Tim Young of Deloitte and John Palguda of the Partnership for Public Service. And John, before we do your number one most important news story of the week, we're running out of time to get folks nominated for the Service to America medals you mentioned during the break. What is the absolute hard deadline, or is there one? I mean, there's got to be one.
Well, there is one, and thank you so much for mentioning that. Officially, it's next Friday, January 16th. But if somebody has started, it's a very easy nomination process. You go to, you know, servicetoamericamedals.org or the partnership website. You do it online. If you started it or you think about starting it and you need a few extra days to finish it, we'll give that to you. So just we'll work with you. It's a wonderful opportunity to recognize, you know, the outstanding people in the federal government. Really encourage agency managers, coworkers, anybody, nominate Service to America Medal, nominate your deserving colleagues.
You and your team do just an amazing, outstanding job with that event. And Tim, you and your colleagues at Deloitte are sponsors of that. And the sponsors that support it are terrific. And I can't say enough about it. It's my favorite event in Washington every year.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun with it. And the good thing is that it recognizes deserving people and puts a face on public service.
Your colleague Tim McManus was on the program not too long ago also talking about some of the resources that you have on servicetoamericamedals.org for people who are putting together nomination packages.
Oh, yeah.
Videos and all kinds of other stuff on there.
Yeah, so we want to make it real easy as possible.
Your most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is FEHBP reform, pay freezes, and lawmakers' other day one priorities in the 114th Congress. Now, some of these on the surface are not particularly friendly to federal employees. But I have to color me cynical, I guess. But I look at some of these, John, and I think these probably are not likely to go very far in the 114th Congress, are they? Let's not get people all excited about some of these things.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I thought, important news stories, it's the start of the 114th Congress. We got to talk about, you know, the role of Congress in the running of government. And you're absolutely right. Some of the things that have already been put on the table aren't going to go anywhere, but a few things will. And it's not, you know, well, let's just watch and see what happens. I think the importance of this story, Francis, is that, you know, a lot of this stuff can fall simply by the weight of the facts. But the facts don't automatically present themselves. I think people need to be ready to have a dispassionate discussion about, look, will these things actually help government deliver services to the American public or not? Now, part of delivering services is we want efficiency. We want effectiveness. We don't want to, you know, we don't have money to throw at stuff. But so I think when we evaluate ideas from our friends up on the Hill for the effective operation of government, we need to be ready to have a fact-based conversation. So I noticed some of the things that are being put out there, which is, well, you know, let's just do this across-the-board spending cut, you know, 1-5%. And that, you know, everybody can always tighten their belt. Well, the fact of the matter is, you know, diet and exercise is good, but taken to an extreme, you've got exhaustion and malnutrition. Interesting in this one proposal put on the table is that they would exempt Defense, Homeland Security, and VA. Well, the thing is, those three agencies employ three out of every five, 60% of the civilian workforce in those three agencies. So we exempt them.
Yeah.
But we put Health and Human Services, which includes the Centers for Disease Control and
NIH,
you know, think of Ebola and stuff.
Right.
We put agriculture on the cutting board. We put Social Security Administration. To simply suggest that, well, yeah, certainly you can take 5% without even looking at has the workload increased, what are the demands, et cetera. But you got to be ready to have the conversation.
And that's the broader point that I think some of these bills make, Tim, is year after year after year after year, Congress is never willing to sit down and, in some cases, force the agencies to come through with the inventory that Senator Coburn pushed for pretty much his entire time in Congress to find out what is it exactly that you're doing, and then let's make decisions based on what we know about each of those things that you're doing.
Yeah, so without going political on this article, which has political orientation, these types of proposals, in my view, exempt a one-size-fits-all, when everybody knows one-size-fits-few. Requiring a 1% or 3% or 5% cut is cutting with a machete versus a scalpel. And the best way, in my view, to cut government spending is on a program-by-program basis by giving those programs an outcome that they need to hit, but giving them the flexibility to cut as necessary, because what works at CDC won't work at necessarily NASA. But this is an example of where Congress is trying to legislate to an outcome with a prescription versus providing some flexibility to government agencies. To the Senator Coburn concept, that is based on a very simple equation that we used at OMB when we stood up USAspending.gov, which provides transparency to all federal spending across.
Got about 30 seconds. Tim.
Contracts and procurements. Transparency to performance gives you clarity to progress. Clarity gives you the opportunity to hold people accountable, and accountability gives you results. I think that simple equation could be applied elsewhere in government to accomplish outcomes without prescribing an input.
John Palguda's most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec: FEHBP reform, pay freezes, and lawmakers' other day one priorities in the 114th Congress. All the stories linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Gentlemen, a terrific federal news countdown. Thanks, Tim Young. Thanks, John Palguda.
Thank you, Francis.
In-depth with Francis Rose, a federal news countdown, back next week on Federal News Radio.
WFED Washington, www.